Wandering lost in a wild land on Christmas Eve, Sir Gawain prayed, "I beg of you, O Lord and Mary, that most merciful of mothers and most dear, find me safe lodgings in some house, devoutly to hear Mass and then your matins tomorrow morning. I meekly ask you, and to this purpose I promptly pray my Pater and my Ave and Creed." This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast, The After Dinner Scholar. Last week formed an introduction to the 14th century poem, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, the Wyoming Catholic College Book of the Year. Our president, Dr. Glenn Arbery, helped us to understand the story, its structure, and its context. But the anonymous author of the tale about Sir Gawain was interested in more than just telling a good tale. He had a clear theological and spiritual purpose as well. Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is an intensely Christian work. To help us understand how that's the case, our guest this week is theologian Dr. Kent Lisnowski. Dr. Lisnowski, the action in the story takes place on two Christmases. The Green Knight shows up on New Year's Eve, and Sir Gawain arrives at Green Chapel a year and a day later on New Year's Day. Why set the story in the context of the feasting, merriment, mirth, and the incarnation of Christ?
Well, ultimately, the story of Christianity is a story of joy, right? It's a story of the coming of our salvation. But the coming of our salvation, while a great reason for joy and feasting and praise and wonder and thanksgiving, the joy is always touched by the temptation, the struggle, the fight, the work, the suffering and death and resurrection, ultimately, of Christ, who's victorious over sin and death. And for the Christian to truly participate in the joy and feasting of the heavenly banquet, he has to overcome with Christ, through the blood of Christ, and share in the cross of Christ to overcome sin and death in his own life. And so this wonderful poem sets forth for us that story in great part because of the context.
In the story, the Green Knight comes and he's looking for a volunteer to receive a blow and to give a blow with this monster battle axe. Sir Gawain volunteers to give and receive the blows from the battle axe, but there's something providential going on here as well. Gawain is not Arthur's greatest warrior, but he leads the Knights of the Round Table in virtue. Could you comment about his virtue?
Absolutely. I think, first of all, the fact that he's not the strongest knight in that sense of physical prowess is indicative of what the Christian story is, right? He's the one who's willing to take the blow. He's the one who's going to take the blow. The weak will be made strong in their weakness, right? But to his virtue, I think that's the key about Sir Gawain. He's got this star, right? That's the central piece that explores his virtue. He's got this star. And the star has 5 points. And each of the points relates to one of the sort of perfections of virtue that he has. First of all, he's without fault in all of his 5 senses. Secondly, his 5 fingers have never been known to falter. Thirdly, his faith has been based in the 5 wounds of Christ, a double 5 there. Fourth, his fortitude in fighting comes from what? The 5 joyful mysteries of the rosary, which is also painted on the inside of his shield. Can you imagine that? So you can behold these mysteries as you're in battle. It's beautiful. And then fifthly, he has the 5 virtues of the knights, which are these: liberality, brotherly love, purity, courtesy, and compassion.
Well, in light of Gawain's virtue, he arrives at the castle just before Christmas, and he's tempted by the lady of the castle, who he thinks is more gorgeous even than Guinevere. How does his virtue and sense of courtesy and courtly love, how do all these things interact in the temptation?
The beautiful piece here is how the author shows him struggle between 2 things, right? One is the courtly behavior of a proper knight, which is to give deference and obedience to any woman, especially one such as this woman who's tempting him, a noble woman, right? And then that's balanced against his oath, right? His faithfulness to the promise he made, which was to be, to share in all the things that he receives while he's in the castle.
The oath he made to her husband.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, the oath he makes to the husband. Also, the third kind of piece that's of course, in there is his need to to respect and defend the goodness of the marriage bond, right, of course, between the nobleman who's hosting him and the wife. So he's got those three things, and the story shows him trying to balance those, right? On the one hand, he has to respond to these temptations in a way that won't insult this woman. At the same time, he has to be faithful and not obviously commit adultery or any kind of heinous sin there. And he has to be faithful to his vow. So we see a man who gives a kiss to his host right at the end of the evening and is rewarded for it somehow. I mean, it's a beautiful thing how he can maintain his chastity, yet sort of accept in a certain way the attention of this woman.
She gives him a kiss, so he gives his host a kiss.
Yes, that sharing. Was the deal they made. And So the host goes out hunting and brings back all these animals and gives the animals to Sir Gawain. And so the parallel there is the man hunting is supposed to be a parallel to the wife who's sort of hunting him. And each of the three hunts represent the way Gawain is attempting to get out of his temptation.
Well, in the last temptation, she gives him a girdle. A girdle, she says, will protect him from being killed. He does not give that to his host.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the girdle and girdles in general.
Right, so the girdle here, keep in mind, on the third day, he does receive a third kiss, and he does give that back to his host. But the girdle, he at first rejects. He says, no, I'm sorry, I cannot, even as a good knight, accept this. But then she adds the power of telling him that it will keep him from death. So for the sake of saving his life, he takes it. And he does not give it to the king. So this is clearly the failing. This is the failing of Gawain here. This is his weakness coming out. And so what's up with this girdle? Why does she give him a girdle? Well, girdles are representative of tying together, holding strong where there might be a weakness. So we look in Christian history, so we see the tradition of St. Thomas, this is the doubting Thomas now, being given a girdle of faith by Mary herself, so that he might believe in her assumption into heaven. Another instance is St. Thomas Aquinas traditionally is given this girdle of chastity as a supernatural gift in his life. So Sir Gawain here is given a girdle as well to cover up for his own natural weakness, that he will die if struck by the Green Knight. But instead of being a gift from the divine, right, a gift from God, it's sort of a gift that brings out evil in him and temptation and actual sin.
How do his temptations then lead to the blow he receives from the Green Knight?
He bravely goes to the chapel. All the while, this bravery is kind of tempered, right, because he has the girdle. So in a certain way, he knows he's going to be okay, or at least he hopes he's going to be okay because of this. And the Green Knight gives him three blows, or not really three blows, but three quasi-blows, right? So he fakes that he's going to hit Sir Gawain, and Sir Gawain flinches. And then he's rebuked by the Green Knight, and he promises to do better on the next time. So then, again, the second time, the Green Knight gives him a fake blow, but he holds fast. And then finally, on the third blow, we find that he only receives a nick on the neck, which ultimately heals, right? But there's a way in which this nick on the neck becomes a scar, which is a sign of his sin, but also ends up ultimately becoming a reminder of God's forgiveness and mercy, right? Because he confesses to the Green Knight that he retained the girdle, and that's why he was able to survive. So he has to sort of have this moment of humility where he says, you know what, it really wasn't on my own power here. I did keep the girdle, and that's how I did this. And the Green Knight has him keep the girdle forever. He takes it back to his home, and all of the rest of the Knights of the Round Table put on a copy of this girdle. So what was the occasion for his sin ultimately now becomes a reminder, not only to himself, but to everyone else of the Round Table, of the weakness of man and the need for grace.
So the badge of his sin becomes suddenly a badge of honor.
Mm-hmm. And so it is with Christ, is it not, right? The mm-hmm. wounds of Christ are a badge of our, are a mark of our sin, but they also become a reminder of the greatness of God's grace, which absorbs our sin and brings it to good.
Yeah. Well, and I think on a personal level, we can receive wounds for our sin that then become reminders and badges of honor for us.
This is very true, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, after Sir Gawain's trial is over, the Green Knight explains that the game of cutting off heads was the idea of Morgan le Fay, Morgan the sorceress. Morgan was Arthur's half-sister, so he's Gawain's aunt, a sorceress, an enemy of Arthur in the Round Table, someone who hates Queen Guinevere so much that she hoped the shock of the severed head talking would kill her. How does knowing that the evil Morgan planned the whole thing inform our theological and spiritual understanding of the poem and of the nature of temptation?
Well, I think it sort of raises the adventure level of our lives, and it ought to. It sort of puts us back into a kind of enchanted view of the world, right? That there really is a battle between powers, right? Dominions, thrones, right? Going on around us and within us, in the sense that the evil spirits would love to attack us and do attack us. So that it's not simply isolated beings fighting temptations that come from nowhere, but that there's somehow something greater and bigger than us going on that surrounds us all the time. And we're a part of that adventure. We're a part of that battle. And it's not just something that's far from us, but something that's close to us too, as this Morgan is close, right, to Gawain.
Yeah, well, she's a companion of the woman in the castle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Finally, tell us something about the Marian aspects of this. How does Mary enter into the story?
Mm-hmm. Mary is saturated throughout, or I guess punctuated more than saturated. Sir Gawain calls out to her for help when he's desperately looking for the Green Chapel on Christmas Eve. He says, "Find me a place of rest, Mary." Right? We see the rosary mysteries are on the inside of his shield, so he's sort of contemplating them for fortitude. We see that ultimately his test takes place when? On the feast of Mary, the Mother of God, right? So Mary is important here, right? As our intercessor, you have Morgan le Fay on the one hand, a sign of all evil, and then you have Mary on the other hand, right? Who's bringing us closer to the Lord and closer to salvation.
Well, thank you very much for this theological perspective on Sir Gawain and the Green Knight.
My pleasure.
As Sir Gawain prepared to ride into the valley to meet the Green Knight and presumably his death, he said, "God's will must be obeyed. His wishes are my own." In Sir Gawain, we see not only the classical virtues of prudence, temperance, justice, and courage, but the theological virtues of faith, hope, and love. Yet he is not perfect. Rather, as Glenn Arbery reminded readers of his weekly email, Jacques Maritain wrote, quote, "A totally perfect finite thing is untrue to the transcendental nature of beauty, and nothing is more precious than a certain sacred weakness and that kind of imperfection through which infinity wounds the finite," close quote. Such is the weakness and the example we have in Sir Gawain. If you don't receive Dr. Arbery's thought-provoking weekly email, visit our website, wyomingcatholic.org, and sign up today. Next week will be the third in our series on Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, and our guest will be Dr. Benjamin Lockhart, a member of Wyoming Catholic College's Catholic Scholars Advisory Board. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.